Shri Yamaraj Vacha.
Shri Yamaraj said,
Aho,
alas,
Amisham,
of these,
Vayasa,
by age,
Adhikanam,
of those advanced,
Vipashyatam,
seen every day,
Lokavidim,
the law of nature,
that everyone dies.
Vimoha,
the bewilderment.
Yatra,
from where?
Agataha,
came.
Tatra,
there.
Gatam,
returned.
Manushyam,
the man.
Swayam,
themselves.
Sadharmaha,
similar in nature.
Prone to die.
Api,
although.
Shochanti,
they lament.
Apartam,
uselessly.
So translation,
Shri Yamaraj said,
alas, how amazing it is.
These persons who are older than me have full experience that hundreds and thousands of living entities have taken birth and died. Thus they should understand that they also are apt to die, yet still they are bewildered. The conditioned soul comes from an unknown place and returns after death to that same unknown place. There is no exception to this rule which is conducted by material nature. Knowing this, why do they uselessly lament? So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The Lord says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter, text 28, Avyakta dini bhutani vyakta madhyani bharata Avyakta nidhananjeva tatraka pari devana. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when they are annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation? Everybody's sitting so far away. It's like, I'm not that scary. It's not that dangerous. You know, I don't fight. So, accepting that there are two classes of philosophers, one believing in the existence of the soul and the other not believing in its existence, there is no cause for lamentation in either case. Non-believers in the existence of the soul are called atheists by followers of Vedic wisdom. Yet even for argument's sake, we accept the atheistic theory, there is still no cause for lamentation. Apart from the separate existence of the soul, the material elements remain unmanifested before creation. From this subtle state of unmanifestation comes manifestation, just as from ether, air is generated, from air, fire is generated, from fire, water is generated, and from water, earth becomes manifested. From the earth, many varieties of manifestations take place. For example, a big skyscraper is manifested from the earth. When it is dismantled, the manifestation becomes again unmanifested and remains as atoms in the ultimate stage. The law of conservation of energy remains, but in the course of time, things are manifested and unmanifested. That is the difference. Then what is the cause for lamentation in either manifestation or unmanifestation? Somehow or other, even in the unmanifested stage, things are not lost. Both at the beginning and at the end, all elements remain unmanifested, and this does not make any real material difference. If we accept the Vedic conclusion as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, anta vanta ime dehaha, that these material bodies are perishable in due course of time, nitya shyokta sarira naha, but that the soul is eternal, then we must remember always that the body is like a dress. Therefore, why lament the changing of a dress? The material body has no factual existence in relation to the eternal soul. It is something like a dream. In a dream, we may think of flying in the sky or sitting on a chariot as a king. But when we wake up, we can see that We are neither in the sky nor seated on the chariot. The Vedic wisdom encourages self-realization on the basis of the non-existence of the material body. Therefore, in either case, whether one believes in the existence of the soul or one does not believe in the existence of the soul, there is no cause for lamentation for loss of the body. Mm. In the Mahabharata, it is said, Adarshanad iha yata punascha darshanam gataha. This statement could support the theory of the atheistic scientist that the child in the womb of the mother has no life, but is simply a lump of matter. To follow this theory, if the lump of matter is aborted by a surgical operation, no life is killed, the body of the child is like a tumor, and if the tumor is operated upon and thrown away, no sin is involved. The same argument could be put forward in regard to the king and his queens. The body of the king was manifested from an unmanifested source, and again it became unmanifested from manifestation. Since the manifestation exists only in the middle between the two points of unmanifestation, why should one cry for the body manifested in the interim? Shriyama uvacha ho amisham vayasadikanam vipashyatam lokavidhim vimohaha yatragadas tatragatam manusham swayam sadharma api shochanjyapartam. So Om Aganat Sumilandasha Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So the context of this particular discussion is that you have Hiranyakashipu preaching to his relatives. This is very interesting that you have a demon who's preaching. And Hiranyakashipu is preaching to his relatives because his dear beloved, Hiranyakshabai, you understand? Hiranyakshabai means brother. That his dear brother, Hiranyaksha, just got killed by Lord Vishnu. And all the relatives, naturally, Hiranyaksha's wives and Hiranyaksha's sons and Hiranyaksha's cousins and everybody else, they're all lamenting and crying. So Hiranyakashipu is preaching philosophy, and we're not actually disagreeing with this philosophy right here. It's interesting how much in tune with the Vedic version even demons are. Very interesting. Like in the many years ago, of course, in the previous yugas, even the demons, they were expert in chanting Vedic mantras. They were expert in different aspects of the philosophy. Like you have our friend Ravana. You all know Ravana? Ravana was so expert in chanting mantras that even the demigods would invite him sometimes because he could pronounce things precisely. And, of course, he had quite a lot of intelligence having 10 heads. Dasa Griva. He could have a whole GBC meeting amongst his different heads. Discussion, you know, cooperation and everything like that. Therefore, he was known as Dasa Griva, which means ten-headed. And sometimes, even when he wanted to kidnap Sita Devi, some of the heads opposed his desire to kidnap Sita Devi. So there was an argument between the heads, but finally, the lusty head won out over the other heads. So, you have Ravana, who was quite expert, and, you know, he was doing all these Vedic rituals. He was worshipping Lord Shiva, doing the Havan, and all these demons, like Kumbhakarna, they worshipped Lord Brahma. I mean, they did Vedic things, and they understood the philosophy, not exactly the full Siddhanta of Krishna consciousness, but they understood the philosophy that you're not the body. It's interesting, even, isn't it? Nowadays, the people in society, we may call them demons. It's better not to call them demons because it doesn't help with preaching. Like if you look at everybody and think they're demons, it's just not productive to having a good relationship with people. So nowadays, the people, and even the word karmi is not a good word for it. Karmi means basically someone who's engaged in fruitive activities according to the Vedic literatures. The precise definition of most people today would be vikarmi. You understand? Because there's karma, vikarma, and akarma, according to the Gita. Karma means activities according to the karmakanja section of the Vedas that elevate you materially, you go to the heavenly planets. And that's karma. And akarma means without karma, means Krishna conscious activities. And vikarma means activities violating the Manu Samhita and the other rule books for human behavior. So the vikarma makes you go down, the karma makes you go up, and the akarma makes you get out of here. You understand the difference? Krishna talks about this. There's karma, vikarma, and akarma. And this is important terms for everybody to understand. So the people nowadays are not karmis, and they're not akarmis. They're vikarmis. Because vikarma means one who violates even the pious activity injunctions of the Vedic literatures, and they're going down. Now, how can we say that? Because basically they're eating meat. And, of course, they're not, as far as the samskaras, they're not performing any of them. None of them. They're not even having vivaha yajna anymore. Just like you had a marriage ceremony. But these people, nowadays, most people just live with each other without getting married. And actually, Prabhupada said, he gave an interesting statement. He said, who will go to the trouble of keeping a cow when they can buy milk in the marketplace? You understand what that means? You know, people can have illicit life or enjoy so-called sex life. Then who will go to the trouble of getting married? Especially the men. You know, the men are rejoicing. They can, not all of you, of course, but, you know, the people engage in illicit activity. So there's illicit sex life. What to speak of intoxication. All sorts of intoxication. Practically every culture has its intoxication. Like in Fiji, you have your kava, you have liquor houses in Fiji, and even many people who are from Indian background are now taking intoxication, isn't it? I mean, it's actually, even you go to the Ram Mandalis, what happens to the Ram Mandalis? After they have Ram Katha, they break out the kava. Oh, it's an interesting point I was making when I was in Fiji, that in these Ram Mandalis, they're chanting the name of Ram, right? Ram Nam. And in spite of chanting the name Ram for how many years, 40, 50, 60 years, why aren't they getting purified? Isn't it, you know, you contrast that with Valmiki, who was Ratnagara before, who chanted Mara that became Ram, and then he got purified, right? He became a great devotee. He was a dacoit, he was a rascal before, and he became purified. So why my question for all of you is, why aren't the people who are in charge of the Ram Mandalis getting purified? Is any
anarthas?
No, but we all have anarthas.
Not following principles.
Not following principles, but there's a better reason for that. There's a more reason. Because, you know, many of us, before we joined the movement, weren't following principles. We began to chant, and then
doing their chores only for that time.
No. What?
Because while they were chanting, they were counteracting it by engaging in illicit activity.
Yeah, but we find people before they joined the movement, especially the hippies in the 1960s, they were chanting and doing illicit activities, and finally they gave it up.
How good it is they are doing it on Guru's order?
Okay, you're getting closer. Yeah. That's pretty close. That's just about it. Because what is that?
They're not chanting the Vaishnava mantra.
That's right.
Mantra.
Exactly. They're not chanting. They're not chanting something received in disciplic succession. Because if you get a mantra that's not in disciplic succession, even Krishna's name, the most it is Namavash. You understand? Namavash means accidentally you're chanting the name of God. Ram is a bona fide mantra. Sita Ram is a bona fide mantra. However, the sound vibration that simply comes from the lips and the tongue moving is not transcendental unless the mantra descends. The statement given in the Vedic literatures is Sampradayavihinai Naye Mantras Tednish Balamataha. That if you receive a mantra and it is not coming into disciplic succession, it will not be effective. In other words, they're not getting the Shuddha Nam. What they're chanting is Namavash, which helps them. But it doesn't bring them to the point of getting rid of the anarthas. Because when we first start chanting, all of us have anarthas. And we've had so much experience of people who started chanting, who were still doing sinful activities, gradually gave them up, right? And I have personal experience By chanting, actually, all the desires simply go away. And Dhruva Maharaj had that experience also, right? What did Dhruva Maharaj want? Kingdom greater than what? Great-grandfather, Lord Brahma. I mean, that's a pretty good demand. I mean, most people would want, you know, a few million dollars or something like that. Or a Mercedes or something. But he wanted the kingdom greater than that of his great-grandfather. And that's the biggest material desire you can have, basically. You want a bigger universe than Lord Brahma. You want the whole universe. In other words, you don't just want to own one country. Like sometimes you have these modern prime ministers or kings or something like that who own a country or in charge of a country, like in Saudi Arabia. But you can own the whole universe. So he gave up that desire. And Valmiki gave up that desire because he received the mantra from a bona fide source. He received the Shuddha Nama. Do you see the difference? Even though we had so many desires in the heart, so many anarthas in the heart, and they weren't chanting purely in the beginning, because maintaining material attachments is one of the offenses on chanting, still they became purified because it was Shuddha Nama. Whereas all these people in the Ram Mandalis, not all, I don't want to say everyone, but most of them in the Ram Mandalis have not received the name from the right source. So they can go on chanting Ram Nam for millions of years, and they're not going to become purified. That's why they're still doing it after so many years. Anyway, so getting back, that was one point I made in Fiji, especially because we were celebrating Ram Nomi there. So getting back to the point, so people take intoxication, it's V-karma. People have illicit sex, it's V-karma. What to speak of gambling, even the government is supporting and running gambling enterprises. Right, and what to speak of meat eating, which is actually such heavy V-karma, that if you eat or have anything to do with killing a cow or any animal, you suffer. Not there are seven people who are involved in that activity who get the karma. Does anyone know the people?
Person who raises the animal.
Kills it, transports it, cooks it, serves it, and eats it. And there's another one you missed. Person who condones it. You know what condoning means? You know, let's say you're sitting with someone in the restaurant and they say, I hope you don't mind, I'm eating meat. And you say, that's fine. That's condoning. You know the word condoning? Condoning means, you know, just say, it's all right. Now, you're not saying it's good, but you're just saying, it's all right, you're eating meat. Don't worry about it. Can you imagine that? What?
What do we say?
We say, Hare Krishna. we said, that's your, I would say that's your choice. You know, something neutral. I wouldn't say, you demon, rakshasa, meat eater, you're going to hell, you know, see you next life as a cow or a chicken or a duck or whatever, or a lobster. But even condoning, I mean, many of us are faced with situations like that, especially if you're in business. You have to sit at a dinner where people are eating or doing different things. I mean, I was in one situation once, several situations, but one time I was with my father, and he had just gone shopping at the supermarket, and he said, can you help carry my bags in? And in one of the bags was meat. And I just had to think about it. I was just like, it was like a conflict. You know, you have these conflicts in your mind, damned if you do, damned if you don't. You understand what I mean, Dan? It's like it's in technical terms, it's called an avoidance conflict. It, whatever you do, you're in trouble. So I thought, if I carry it, oh, I'll be displeasing Krishna, bad karma. And if I don't carry it, he is going to get angry. So basically, I explained to him. I said, please excuse me. I'm really sorry. You know, I can't do this because of my religious beliefs. I hope you understand. And he was all right with it. He was all right with it. Another time I was at a conference, and it was a conference of people who were supposed to be cultivating compassion, compassion conference. Not a Hare Krishna conference, but I was a conference. Anyway, I was at a conference, and they were serving out things that were not so agreeable. I, of course, had just gone to the supermarket and gotten raw vegetables, so I was sitting, I pulled up my grocery bag. It's interesting, isn't it? I pulled out the bag from the supermarket and put all the sprouts and everything on the table. Even though it looked weird, I did it. I didn't care. And then there was an announcement by the cook, you know, that tonight we have a special dish for you, a chicken cacciatore or something like that. And it was a compassion conference, so I couldn't keep myself from saying, what about compassion for the poor chicken? You know, I said it really loud, and everybody got angry with me. And somebody, like, stuck his elbow right in me, saying, you know, these are all people the same age as me. So, and they said, shh, you're discouraging people. So in other words, anyway, getting back to the point, so this, you're responsible even if you condone the activity. I mean, you could sit there and have them do it. That's not your responsibility. But if you say, it's all right, that's condoning. So the activity, these sinful activities are so contaminated, even if you're associated with them in any way, like, you know, Prabhupada here in the purport mentions abortion, like killing people, killing children in the womb. If you're associated in any way with that, then you have to take a reaction. So that's vikarma. And therefore, generally, we should call people vikarmis, although that's not so sensitive. So we just have other terms like non-devotees or conditioned souls. Conditioned souls is actually better. It's a more compassionate way to look at people. So I don't really look at people, even though I know they're vikarmis, I don't look at them as vikarmis. I look at them as conditioned souls or people struggling to be happy. So that's very important. So here we find Yamaraj speaking, and this is in the context of Hiranyakashipu trying to placate or pacify his relatives who were lamenting. And this story is, just going back in the chapter a little bit, is that Yamaraj was speaking because there was a king from Usinara who died, and all the kings, queens, and everything like that were lamenting, and Yamaraj took the form of a little boy to talk to them. And this story is being related by Hiranyakashipu to sort of make his relatives feel better because they were crying. So that's really important to understand the context of this story. Then the other point is that Hiranyakashipu understood Vedic philosophy as well as the other personalities I mentioned earlier. But they didn't understand one thing. They didn't understand that the purpose of all this, which is, in philosophy, is called teleology, meaning the purpose of reincarnation. They understood reincarnation, they understood karma, they understood the person was not the body, but they didn't understand why this is all going on. And that's the main difference. Like a scientist, for example, of course, many scientists don't accept reincarnation, but a scientist can analyze the whole material energy and answer all the how questions, but they can't answer any of the why questions. How means, just like, I think I spoke about this before here, like they'll ask, the children will ask their parents sometimes, why is the sky blue? And the parents will explain, in one sense, that it's due to the refraction of the sunlight through the atmosphere. Just like if you have a prism and you refract the light through the prism, then you get melted colors. Anyone's ever played with a prism before? That means you take your chandelier. I used to take my mother's chandelier apart. You know, chandelier? You know what a chandelier is? Like, yeah, like that. But what my mother's chandelier had Austrian crystal in it. You know, very expensive crystal. So when she wasn't looking, I would take off the crystals. She didn't like that very much. And I would look through the crystals or put light beams through the crystals, and then you'd have the spectrum, the full spectrum of colors. So the scientists explain, or you would explain to a young person, that's why the sky is blue. But that's not really why the sky is blue. That's how it's blue. That's the mechanism by which it manifests blueness. But the why question has to do with intention or purpose. Like if I ask you, why did you come here this morning? And you answer in a how answer, like you say, I asked you, why did you come here? And you said, I took the train. I said, I didn't ask you how you got here. I asked you why you came here. Why you came here is perhaps to hear a class or maybe to associate, and you have some social life or whatever after class with everybody. You know, there's various reasons you're all here. I mean, I have to be honest. Or attend Mangalarti, or, you know, there's going to be some good prasadam later on. And you're just sitting through class because, you know, that's the way you pay for class. You'd look pretty bad if you just came for prasadam. So that's the why answer. You understand the difference between why and how? So the scientists can explain how, but they can't explain why. And similarly, Hiranyakashipu is able to explain how things happen in this world, and is also trying to say to them, just be detached, because, you know, you're going to die, everybody dies, or as the Mahabharata says, what, hani hani bhutani gachanti yamalayam, that everyone is going to Yamaraj, and the most wonderful thing, kimascharya taparam, the most wonderful thing is we think we're not going to die. Isn't that amazing? Like, recently I've spoken at a lot of funerals, and, you know, generally I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to be laying there any day, or my buddy's not going to lay there. I'll just go to everybody else's. And then, sometimes I have a little shock. I look at the body that's lying there, and I think, one day I'll be lying there. And then my mind says, no, not you. You know? Not you, you know, you have a lot of prasadam to eat, you know, you're enjoying life, like that. So we vacillate, and it means go in between both extremes. We think, one day I'll be there, I better become detached. The next time, no. I'm a sannyasi, you know, just a Hare Krishna. So that's a hani hani bhutani gachanti yamalayam, that we see everybody else die, and we think, we're not going to die. And so Yamaraj is pointing this out, and this is in the story Hiranyakashipu is telling, so he can point it out to his relatives. However, guess what? You can point it out all you want, but it's not going to make people very detached, because there has to be a change of heart. For example, you can go to the hospital, and someone is suffering, and you can tell them they're not the body.
Yeah.
I mean, just don't try it, because you'll get thrown out of the hospital, you know, or you're going to get someone really angry at you. Let's say someone is suffering, they just broke their leg or something, and you say, Prabhu, you're not that body, you know, forget about this pain. You don't have to take pain reliever. Forget about the morphine, you know.
Yeah.
Just chant Hare Krishna, and you'll be happy. Guess what? Doesn't work. Because if you, Upadesho Imurkanam Prakopai Nishanti, if someone is not self-realized or someone is foolish, you give them good instruction, it just makes them angry. So we generally don't do that in our counseling sessions at hospitals. We generally don't tell people they're not the body or you're in Maya. You know, someone's crying, you're in Maya, Prabhu. Or that, you know, the wife is crying because the husband is in the hospital. That's Maya. Don't cry over your husband. He's not your husband. Actually, Krishna's your husband. You have a relationship with Krishna. And this body is just a tridaduke, just bile, mucus, and air. You're crying over a bag of stool. I remember in the early days of the movement, people would give these heavy classes like that, talking about the constituent elements of the body. And, you know, disgusting classes. And it never made anyone detached. It was funny for people, but it never made anyone detached. So what Hiranyakashipu is doing is not going to detach people. I mean, it's good to give them a little philosophy, but it's not going to really detach people from the attachment that they had to the previous person. Because even if you understand the person is not the body, you're still lamenting their loss, because there's the soul within the body. So what really detaches us from these external things is the engagement in devotional service. Vasudevi Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Jinayati Asu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayad Ahoitakam. And that's a famous verse from the Bhagavatam. If one engages in Krishna consciousness, Bhagavati, then Jinayati Asu Vairagyam, he gets knowledge and detachment from this world. So how does that detachment manifest itself that a devotee has? It manifests itself ultimately because one is identifying with the spiritual body. You can't become detached by negation. That never works for the Maya bodies. They try to negate, I'm not this body, I'm not this body, I'm not this body, Aham Brahmasmi, because that's one of their favorite mantras. Aham Brahmasmi, or also Tatvamasi, and all these other mantras like that. But, or, because we have the Gita, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma and the Shochati Nakangshati, one who is on the Brahma Bhuta platform, neither hankers nor laments. But simply negation doesn't make you detached, but identification with your real spiritual identity. And that's what we're aiming for in Krishna consciousness, to understand our spiritual body, what our relationship is with Krishna. And, of course, that's a very advanced stage, but right now we concentrate on relationship with our spiritual master, with Srila, and also with Srila Prabhupada, and relationship with the deities, and relationship with the holy name, and all those other things. And our sense of loyalty to Guru, our sense of loyalty to Krishna. And this helps us become detached in the intermediate stage. But in the long run, your detachment occurs because of identifying with your spiritual form in the spiritual world. In other words, a pure devotee, you see him here, but he understands, according to the Bhagavad Gita, when this body is rising up, sitting down, you know, evacuating or doing anything, he's not doing anything. He's just operating the machine for Krishna. But that complete detachment only occurs at the time of complete realization. But in the meantime, we're dependent upon our loyalty to the Guru, our devotion to Guru, to keep us going and tolerate things. Tamsa tikshisha bharata. So, anyway, simply preaching how we're not the body is not going to make people detach from this material world. Maybe at the funeral it'll help people be detached. Like Prabhupada talked about, smarshana vairagya, that means detachment at the crematorium. But that's only for a few minutes. I mean, you see that, like people go to the funeral and they'll be very detached, talk a little philosophy, and then a week later, what are they doing? They're watching Bollywood films again. Right?
Some might be depressed.
Depressed? A week later, you know, let's say 2 or 3 weeks later, they watch Bollywood films. Or they're depressed, like you say. They can use an escape mechanism, either watching Bollywood, but their attachment continues. Their detachment that they experienced at the funeral home or at the crematorium doesn't continue for more than a little while. So permanent detachment only occurs when one has spiritual realization of one's spiritual identity. And in the meantime, jivera surupuhoi, nitya krishnas, we identify ourselves as servants of Krishna, and that helps a little bit in the meantime. So any questions or comments about any of these points? Yeah, Anamali?
Identify with the spiritual body, identify with spiritual form, you mentioned, and I have been looking at it, but the algorithm has turned around and said to us, it will come.
It will come automatically, yeah.
Automatically. But what would I look like? This is what I'm looking for.
What do you look like? If I told you now, you wouldn't know what to do with it. Like if I said to Rupa here that you're a cow in the spiritual world.
Giant.
Well, he'd say Hari Bol, but then he would start walking on all fours, moo, moo. You know, he wouldn't know what to do with it internally. But it comes, yes, it comes automatically. That's what I'm saying. It's a more advanced stage. But one confirms that with advanced Vaishnavas too. Let's say you're feeling some attachment. This is also part of sadhana bhakti. Let's be more precise. There's different levels of performing devotional service. There's sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, and prema bhakti, according to Nectar Devotion. Under the sadhana means practice, actually. Under the heading of sadhana, there's two divisions. One is vaidhi, and the other one is raganuga. So the first one is vaidhi. We're following the rules and regulations, and we're attached because we have some dedication to our spiritual master, a sense of duty, keeping our promises. These are all reasons why we continue. Like in the modern day, people have a hard time keeping promises. They say promises are made to be broken, right? And even if you have a contract, you have the fine print on the contract. And even people get married now, they have prenuptial agreements that when we get divorced, you get the dog and I get the house. That's true. I mean, I don't know if it's that bad, but, you know, we break it up 50% or something like that. So because it's Kali Yuga, the principle of truthfulness is diminishing. But we as devotees should stick to our vows and promises. Like we were just celebrating Ramayan, Lord Ram's appearance, Ram Nomi. And we know that Lord Ram had one wife, one arrow, and one word, right? You ever hear that before? One wife, one arrow, and one word. One word. So when he gave his word for something, that's there in the Valmiki Ramayan. Lord Ram would say, I have one arrow. In other words, every arrow he fires hits the point. One wife, that means just Mother Sita. And then one word, that means when he says something, it happens. So we should stick to that too when we make a promise. Prabhupada was very shocked when people made promises and they didn't stick to their promises, because Prabhupada expected more. And the first time a devotee actually broke his promises, Prabhupada cried because he couldn't understand what was happening, because he came from such a high-class culture. So in the beginning, we function according to our promises and our dedication, our loyalty to the guru. And also we have other motivations like Chaturvidha Bhajanti Mam. We came because we're in distress. We came because we want wealth. We came because we're inquisitive or want knowledge. But then as we perform sadhana bhakti, the vaidhi, talking about the vaidhi first, then there begins to become a natural attraction for some particular persons in Vrindavan. You know, that means some eternal residence. Like Yashoda Mai, Nanda Maharaj, Subal, Sudam, Lalita Vishaka, Radharani. I mean, anyway, we tend to have an attraction towards a particular Rus. And then that is confirmed. That comes naturally when we're actually fixed up in Vaidhi. Then it starts to occur. It's like the rising of the sun in the morning, that you see a little bit of light. You don't see all the light when the sun begins to rise. You see a little bit of glimmer of light. In the beginning, everything is black and white too, right? You don't even see colors when the sun is just starting to come over the horizon. So then you get some glimpse. Then you talk to the guru, and you know, Srila Prabhupada's representatives, because we're in ISKCON, we don't go outside of ISKCON, we don't run to Radha Kund and say, hey, Babaji, who am I? Many devotees did that, and they've lost their connection with Prabhupada, and when you break a connection with Prabhupada, it's hard for me to understand how anyone can be spiritually situated. So, but we can confirm, and then, you know, I have this natural attraction, and then you can do some manasa seva. It means seva in the mind. Like you may meditate on cooking sweet rice for Radha and Krishna or something like that. Right?
He got his fingers
back. Oh, yeah, like that Brahmin who was meditating on cooking sweet rice. He touched it to see if it was cool enough, and then he burnt his finger, and then Krishna took him back to Godhead. So you can meditate on that. You can meditate on some aspects of the deity worship, like swinging Radha and Krishna. You can meditate on hearing Krishna's flute. And so this meditation is a natural part of the progressive march of devotional service. It's still a sadhana because you're practicing. It's not bhava, it's not prema, but you're practicing seva internally. And this is an important stage. I mean, devotees shouldn't neglect this stage when they're ready for the stage. You understand? They shouldn't neglect that stage. It's an important stage for one to have. I mean, even if you can't realize who you are in the spiritual world, at least you can meditate on deity worship or something, some service for Krishna as you're chanting. It's actually important. It's actually an important thing to understand how to step up to the next stage of devotional service. That's still practice. And then that's Raghunuga Bhakti, where you... And also you're particularly attracted to a ragatmaka devotee, which means someone whose atma is raga, which means a pure eternal associate of Krishna. And then the next stage after that is bhava bhakti, when you begin to experience ecstasies. Like Goranga Balite Havipulaka Shurir. Whenever you hear Krishna's names, whenever you see something remind you of Krishna, that's called a vibhava. And then in the final stage you have prema, when you completely realize your spiritual identity and you're internally having pastimes with Krishna. While everybody is watching you here, you know, you're sitting in class, like Rupa's sitting in class, but I'm not saying he's at that platform, but internally he's milking cows with Krishna. You know, but you can't tell. That's why it says that nobody should try to think that a pure devotee is an ordinary person. Because you can't tell externally. And even if someone is on that platform, they're not going to tell you about it. The only thing you can see externally is if someone's up to the platform of nishta. That you can judge. Nishta means steadiness. But you can't judge someone beyond that. You can judge someone at nishta, but you can't see they have ruchi, you can't see ashakti, and you can't see bhava, and you can't see prema externally. But you can see nishta. Nishta is pretty easy to see. Is someone steady in their sadhana? Is someone steady throughout the rest of the day? Two aspects of nishta, according to the acharyas, the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He said steadiness in one sadhana, steadiness throughout the rest of the day. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. About this gurus, according to Guru Astaka.
Yeah.
Gurus are becoming manjaris. Manjaris to gopis or Radharani.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, their position, is that the rupa they get? Rupa?
The guru, well, some gurus are, it's not that every guru is manjari. I mean, you have many associates of Lord Chaitanya who gave initiation to others who were, I mean, you have devotees who are Rambhaktas too, amongst the, like Murari Gupta. You have some who were coward boys. You have Goridas Pandit, for example, who is a bona fide guru, and his disciple was Hriday Chaitanya, and they were both situated in Sakya Ras. They were both coward boys. Yet Hriday Chaitanya had a disciple in Madhurya Ras. That was Shyamananda. So it's not that, I mean, some people make propaganda that all the gurus are actually manjaris. It's not necessarily true. We can find examples. If they say all the gurus were manjaris, then if we find one example where it's not true, then their whole argument goes out the window.
And they
can be in any rasa. I mean, just like I said, Goridas Pandit, the perfect example is Goridas Pandit and Hriday Chaitanya. And they were definitely in Sakya Ras. There's no doubt about it. What to speak of all the associates of Lord Nityananda. And they were gurus. And they were generally the associates of Lord Nityananda are Sakya Ras. Yeah, generally. Virabhadra was Lord Nityananda's son, was Sakya Ras, and he was a guru of so many millions, or at least thousands, tens of thousands of personalities. Whereas Lord Nityananda's wife, Janava, she was in Madhurya Ras. Janava Mata. She was Ananga Manjari in Krishna's pastimes. She was a Manjari. That's Janava Mata. You all heard of Janava Mata?
Yeah.
She was Lord Nityananda's wife. Yeah. So she was a great guru in our sampradaya. And she was in Madhurya Ras. Whereas many others of Lord Nityananda's followers were Sakya Ras. Whoop, the phone. Krishna's calling from the spiritual world. This is your Ras. I wish it was so easy, isn't it? Yeah, Rupa.
Two questions, Maharaj. One, on the fine line of condoning people eating meat, what about, you know, say it's your dad's 83rd birthday and they want you to come along and
yeah,
you're going to, you know, have some vegetarian food, but everyone else is eating meat.
As long as you don't say, it's all right. I mean, many times we have to sit in places where people are eating meat. You know, I went to someone's 90th birthday last year, and it was in a restaurant, and I had to sit there, but, you know, I just told them to give me fruit. I'm not even going to eat boiled vegetables in a meat restaurant, or any restaurant. So, yeah, but I didn't say, and most of them were eating fish. And I didn't say, yeah, you demons. Guess what you're going to be in your next life? Fish. You know, and, you know, I just wasn't condemning or condoning because I understood the situation. And they were respectful of my diet. But if you get into too much condemnation, you're going to make a lot of enemies. Or if you get into condoning, you make Krishna your enemy.
The second question was, these days a lot of devotees, go to vegetarian restaurants, these Asian vegetarian restaurants, no onion, garlic even, and maybe some Western vegetarian restaurants that are vegetarian. What can you say about this?
Well, I can say what Prabhupada said, if you eat food cooked by a non-devotee, your mind becomes wicked. Because everything in this world is connected with certain modes of nature. And you get those modes of nature when you come in contact with them. Karanam guna sangasya sadasa janma jonishu, as Krishna says in the Gita. So I'm very careful. I don't eat anything unless I know who's cooking. Even in a temple, I won't eat unless I know who's done the cooking. I'm that strict. I'm not saying you have to be that strict. I'm just saying I do that. I have to know who's doing the cooking, whether they're following strictly Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, I won't eat. It's simple as that. Or I'll just eat raw food.
What will happen?
If
you eat the food cooked by non-devotees?
Well, it depends on what mode of nature they're in. If they're in the mode of ignorance, like they're, you know, they may be vegetarians, but they may be drinking a lot too. Then you're affected by the mode of ignorance. Like Prabhupada said that the reason Grandfather Bhishma and Drona took up the opposite side, the wrong side in the battle of Kurukshetra, is because their minds were contaminated by eating in the kitchen of Duryodhana. And it's not that Duryodhana was the cook, but, you know, I guess he hired people with the same mentality. So because there's subtle rules of material nature. Like when you associate, like Lord Chaitanya said, the first rule for a devotee is a satsanga chage vaishnava char. First rule for a devotee is give up bad association. And so eating, when you eat, the food becomes transformed into blood. And the blood carries the consciousness. So practically, I cannot think of a more direct way of associating with someone than eating something they cooked. Right? I mean, to me, it's even more direct than hearing from someone or shaking their hand. Because blood carries the consciousness. Food, according to the Ayurveda, becomes transformed after a few steps into the blood. And so you're having this blood. It's like getting a transfusion from someone. You know, getting a transfusion from someone who is not Krishna conscious. You also get the liquor in the blood. Yeah, can you imagine that liquor? So,
there's another thing about this. Taking from the food point of view, then you go and buy, fill up your bag.
Yeah.
From the vegetable shop or at the market.
Yeah.
The people is grown by meat eaters. And drinkers and everybody else, eh?
Yeah.
So, but you are paying for it.
Yeah.
Where does it cut off?
Prabhupada said when you pay for it, it gets there's some purification when you pay for it. If they just gave it to you, then there would be some more connection. But it's the cooking process itself,
right,
where the heat is involved. It's a subtle law of material nature.
Something like
especially with rice or grains. Like Prabhupada was more emphasized more grains than he did like just vegetables or something like that, like rice especially.
So when cooking takes place, it's like a yajna?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, right.
Exactly. There's some
purification.
there's some like injection of the person's consciousness when you're cooking. Mm-hmm. And you can taste the difference. I mean, even scientifically, it has been proven. In Japan, they did this test with water crystals where someone had said different things or thought different things, and water crystals looked different. And some of you may be aware of this test. Like someone was thinking very hatefully, and the water crystals were all like in a disarray. They looked really ugly. And someone was thinking love, 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 or something like that when they picked this up, and the water crystals were very beautiful, very nicely formed and everything. So consciousness, even modern scientists admit that consciousness affects matter. Yeah.
Without offense to anyone, can we continue tomorrow?
Without offense. All right, yeah, we continue tomorrow. Yeah, anyway. Govardhan is the king, you know. He's the king of all mountains. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Giriraj. So Giriraj has just told us that we have to end, because we have a schedule today, because he's concerned. I mean, that's natural. Okay, I guess that's it. All glory is to his divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.